Bailing out Wall Street is the only way to save Main Street, so says the president.
And in the last 24 hours, many founders, investors that I've talked to have been desperately trying to get their money out.
We are at the beginning of a very classic late cycle, late big cycle debt crisis.
Can you characterize everything that the Fed has done this past week as essentially flooding the system with money?
Yes.
The Bitcoin system is so perfect that I think it's going to be the future.
Hey, Dave, how's it going?
Hey, it's good. How are you?
Doing well. The halving is 7, 8, 8 or 9 hours away.
Wait, can you remind me, is it the doubling or the halving?
It's the halving of Bitcoin's price.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Supposedly it's like going to be around 8 p.m. my time. And there's a bunch of people going to a place in Nashville, downtown Nashville, to like have drinks and eats and hang out. So I might head there later.
Cool. Yeah. I think a few people are getting together where I am, but it's a smaller group. So.
Well, what do you make of all of this? Do you think it's priced in?
Well, I think that what's interesting about this halving is that in terms of like basis points of inflation rate issuance, it's a lot less than previous halvings.
Mm. Say right? More. Like, what do you mean by that?
So if you look at like Bitcoin's, we included this chart in our weekly newsletter, but if you look at Bitcoin's rate of inflation, or like, and this is inflation in a more traditional sense, like money supply issuance, not like, you know, price levels or CPI or like whatever, you know, the Fed right. uses nowadays. But if you think about it, like past halvings, it would go from like, you know, 13.9% supply issuance to like, you know, 4.5%, mm-hmm. or, you know, 3 or 4 to like 2 or 1.85 mm-hmm. or whatever. So this is like 1.7 or 7.5 to, I think like 1.7 to 0.85. So it's a 85-ish basis point reduction in Bitcoin's inflation rate. Mm-hmm. And that is a lot less than past reductions just because of like, you know, math.
Right.
And so it's like less of an, it like, it's basically just like less impactful.
Right. Right. So it's not that it's priced in or not. It just doesn't maybe have as much effect on the price, but my understanding of the way that halvings affect supply is that mining, the way mining economics works is part of the way that miners fund their operations, which are funded in dollars, right? Because they pay for energy in dollars, they pay for capital equipment in dollars, they take out loans in dollars. So the part of the way that they sustain their operations is they sell some amount of Bitcoin into the market for dollars, and in order to pay their obligations or liabilities. And so that is like kind of embedded in their business model. Now, if all of a sudden they're making a lot less money, then a lot of those mining operations will have different operational dynamics. The question I would have is, I mean, obviously this is the most predictable, the least surprising thing ever, right? We've known that this mm-hmm. day would come since 2009. So if you are running a mining operation, you know, you would be projecting, you would be incorporating halvings into your forward projections. You don't know the price of Bitcoin, but you probably have, you know, strategy or a range in your strategy of possible prices. And then you would know kind of ahead of time. I mean, price is sort of unpredictable, but for 6 months we've been up here now. And so you kind of would have the opportunity to like, okay, I'm no longer making money. You know, maybe I want to if you want to close up shop, let's say, you would want to sell your mining equipment or recapitalize your operation long before this time. And so my question would, you know, there's been a lot of talk about like, oh, there's a certain amount of miners that will turn off their machines. That could be the case for like home miners and smaller operations, but for the big ones, you would think that not only has the halving been priced in and the market and the Bitcoin price, but that the halving's been priced into like the mining economy for a long time.
Yeah, because like the price of electricity, that's pretty known, right? And I think one thing that's interesting, like, is that like people have done research and shown that like post halving, certain machines that are online today, like types of machines, like the ant miners and what have you, that like those machines are now unprofitable based on certain electricity prices. And so they'll be like taken offline or repurposed. And like you were saying, like, of course that will be done in advance or with some planning.
If anybody wants to investigate the actual models, there's a great website that I use called ASIC Miner Value, I think, .com. And you can search for any ASIC, actually not only Bitcoin, but other mining machines. And you can input your electricity cost and it will tell you how much it's earning or your break even date. The thing about it is anybody who's in mining will tell you all those calculators are like, no matter how much you try to be pessimistic with what you input into them, they seem to always be too optimistic. That was my experience anyway. And so just be careful with that. But anyway, it's better to have the model, I suppose, than not. I haven't looked recently, but it'd be interesting to see if there's anything there that would tell you which machines suddenly would become like unprofitable after the halving.
Yeah, I read some sort of like Antminer S19 or something was like now gonna, what I read, I think it was based on the average US kilowatt per hour price. Mm-hmm. So like, obviously there are different prices across states, cities, et cetera. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm seeing S19 Pros, the older ones from a few years ago now, they're still making like $3 a day. But let's see if you go in and, I guess there's no way to like tell it to model out the halving, but obviously I guess you would just cut it in half. So maybe it'll make $1.50 a day after this. So still okay. Not great.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to put a price on potentially no KYC Bitcoin, right?
Yep.
It's pretty cool. That's why, like, at least for, obviously there's like peer to peer, but like you can either mine it, or in the US you can mine it. You can like know somebody that sells you as Techo vouchers. Those are cool. You can like buy those with cash.
Yeah.
But what's tough with those is like, they're oftentimes you can like redeem the vouchers using, LNURL. I've ran into this recently where like there's not that many wallets that like support that besides like a Phoenix wallet, which is a little bit challenging to set up. So you know, it's just,
you can't redeem on chain with Aztec Co.
You can. I just experienced if you're, say you're trying to distribute like small amounts via the vouchers, where it really makes sense to redeem via Lightning.
Well, what else happened this week?
Well, what I actually think is interesting to talk about is, well, so the Fed dialed back rate cut expectations. Basically, they had to. I mean, there's like, they either had to or risk losing credibility. And so we don't know what's actually going to happen, but they had to say that they were like, you know, dialing it back. And that, in addition to new geopolitical risk, has, I think, undoubtedly had an effect on Bitcoin's price. I mean, we saw that like Bitcoin dropped, And I think
that just came back.
Yeah, and then came back. It's really interesting. I mean, it's like I saw a tweet that that made me laugh, and it said, "Who are these people that just like shift their entire portfolios and sell off a ton of things as soon as an event happens?" And like obviously these are professional, you know, portfolio managers and stuff, but it is funny to see, like, you know, something bad is happening and like risk gets sold off like as soon as it happens. I mean, like,
but it's the toilet paper fallacy from COVID. It's like, I think other people are going to sell, so I should.
Yeah. Or like, yeah. Or you sell it and then it dumps and then you like try to buy it back at what you think the bottom is. And
exactly.
Then, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, trading, right? So another thing that was interesting was Cynthia Lummis and Kirsten Gillibrand have released their version of a stablecoin bill. So this is the Senate bill. Mm-hmm. And that's different from the House bill. So there's a House bill in the works between McHenry, who's a Republican. He's pro like crypto, and then Maxine Waters, who's a Democrat. She's broadly like anti crypto, although she was pretty cozy with SBF.
Yeah, saw that. Everyone saw that picture.
Yeah, exactly.
Both had a big grin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so McHenry and basically the Lummis Gillibrand bill doesn't matter because the House bill is an unknown. Like they're still hammering that stuff out, but potentially they're working on it. But I still thought that there were some interesting things in the Lummis Gillibrand bill. Number one being like, you could release a stable coin as like a state chartered bank until you hit 10 billion in deposits. And then you had to like get Fed approval, stuff like that. Hmm. So an interesting framework there. Number two, banning algorithmic stablecoins. So no Terras in the US. Also no Athenas, which is this ETH yield-bearing stablecoin that is blowing up abroad. Because, I mean, it's like one of these, you know, they do a bunch of complicated stuff to pull some yield off of like staking whatever complicated high yield ETH stablecoin thing.
Yeah.
So that stuff would not be allowed. And I just think it's like, it's a pretty solid bill. It's just, and they think that a lot of people think that stablecoin legislation will happen this year. We just have yet to see it.
Before or after November is the question.
Yeah. And it also depends on like what bills it gets like tacked onto.
Yeah.
And like how Congress has been operating. And I say this as somebody that only like kind of casually observes it, is that like, you know, there's something that they have to pass, like, well, and I say have to as in like they feel like they have to. So like, you know, defense spending bills or something so that they can like spend all our money on defense. Right. Then that's when like the extras get added on. And so this stablecoin bill to them is like, it's an extra. So it's like, what will this get like tacked onto?
Oh, wow.
And so we'll have to see like which one, and like, it has to make like a little bit of sense, at least like strategically, to like tack it onto something. So we'll see what that is.
Wow. Well, what about the Fed cutting back expectations for rate cuts? That's a big one.
Yeah. I think that will have more implications for, we've already seen it that like in commercial real estate, firms are trying to push off refinancing at these like higher rates, because if they do, then they'll have to like, you know, go delinquent potentially. Like it's harder when you have these like properties that are worth less and you have to refinance at a higher rate. So they're trying to like push that off, to push off a like losses for the bank and the commercial real estate company. Mm-hmm. And so that causes more pain for commercial real estate. It just makes that it like, and by extension, regional banking. And so, or the regional banks that hold a lot of
seems like there's a lot of pressure on real estate. So you also have the recent case that determined that the kind of the cost structure of how real estate agents are paid is changing, which will also, it will also serve to kind of drive price discovery on even like residential real estate in a way that's been distorted in the past. And I think that maybe bodes well for kind of consumers in the medium term, but it could mess with that market as well. So you have commercial real estate, you have residential real estate, you have a regional banking system and community and small banking system, which is very exposed to this sector. They underwrite a lot of these commercial real estate loans and carry a lot on their balance sheets. I just wonder if, you know, just this constant pressure on real estate, and it hasn't cracked yet, really in any significant way, but that's something to watch in the second half of this year. The cracks are starting to show. They've been showing for a long time. It's really hard to, with this stuff, because you and I like to talk about kind of, you know, ground, like earlier when we laughed about trading, that's not our thing. We talk about like data and, you know, concepts grounded in theory of sound money, Austrian economics, and you know, none of this stuff makes sense. It's like the money and financial system is so under the thumb of centralized authorities that it's very hard to read the tea leaves. And it's very, and they have a lot of tools to distort the market in ways that they head fake you. And so you look at commercial real estate, residential real estate, all signs point to trouble. And it will play out. It's just a question of like, how long can they keep the music going before people have to find a chair? And it could be years. I mean, it's really hard to say.
Yeah, it is. It's kind of funny. Think back to all the macro podcasts that we've been listening to for years. How much of the doom stuff that they've said like last year came true or 2 years ago? I mean, some of it, yeah, but not like, not all of it. And so it's just a good point to like temper how the world like should work with like all sorts of, I don't even know.
Empiricism.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, don't underestimate the power of corrupt money to bend.
Definitely.
The economy to the will of individual bureaucrats and temporary politicians.
Although gold has been really going up. Like, I think that's pretty interesting. I mean, it broke 2400 last night, and just, I think that
it is.
Yeah.
Well, it is. But on the other hand, that's also part of the same system of manipulation, right? Because it's most the prices, the spot price of gold depends on paper products and futures, and you know, the price is manipulated as well. I mean, you can't say all this over here with commercial real estate is fake because it's born of like manipulation, but then gold's popping and that signal. It's hard to say that, especially in the short term. I think long term, if you see gold continue just like Bitcoin has for the last 15 years, if over the course of a decade gold and Bitcoin start to become a more significant part of people's portfolios, you could say that there's sort of a fundamental change in the outlook of investors and how they think about sound money. So we'll see.
Yeah. Well, I think there is the biggest thing that I've kind of changed my mind on is like, none of these things are like hedges anymore. No. We've gone from like hedge to safe haven, and safe haven is completely different from hedge. And
say something. Like, what do you mean by that?
Well, like a hedge is something that you think of as like, you know, I constantly keep a 1% gold, or like, you know, you could think Bitcoin, but like most people traditionally think of like it as gold.
Yeah.
And they're like, I keep 1% of my portfolio in gold to hedge against inflation because what's funny is like a hedge should like balance it out. And gold hasn't really been a good like inflation hedge. Mm-hmm. So that whole concept I think is kind of silly. Like you would hedge one thing happening with like another happening. Like a good hedge is like you could hedge your portfolio for volatility by having options or something that like that you pay like a monthly premium to have this like trade ongoing, but that like every couple of years when volatility goes crazy and your portfolio like dumps, you have this one position that makes you a bunch of money and mm-hmm. that hedges your portfolio against that risk. So that's like an ideal hedge, but historically people have like held gold as like an inflation hedge. And now that has changed from people are no longer like, oh, I got to have a little bit of gold to be hedged on inflation. Now they're like, I have to own a bunch of gold or a bunch of Bitcoin, really Bitcoin too, like in significant amounts to protect my wealth from currency debasement and like confiscation and like to protect myself from all of these forces. And so a safe haven is a much stronger narrative, both from a like just the narrative itself and like what you do with your portfolio in accordance to that narrative.
You know what I like about that framing too is it's less focused on price. So a hedge, like you just said, is something that balances price, whereas a safe haven, you think about it as like a physical asset that is physically safe from the outside world. The haven comes, it's like a, you know, the haven comes over it and it's a physical, it's physically separate. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Exactly. All right. Well, you want to leave it there?
Yeah, I think so. And I think that the safe haven concept is so powerful. I think that's a good thing to think about and leave it on. And it's a pretty, I think out of all of the things that have been happening recently, that's what really signals to me that things are changing. That like people are thinking about saving and protecting their wealth in those terms and not like, you know, hedging. So
I want to give a shout out to us who's going to be re-listening to this in 4 years. Hopefully this podcast will still be going 4 years from now at the next time that there's a halving. But thanks, David, and enjoy your halving party. And we'll talk to you next week.
Likewise. Sounds good.
Take care.